You're listening to Mom and Doc Talk, where we talk all things healing pans and pandas with an emphasis on homeopathy. Welcome to Mom and Doc Talk. We are excited to be joined by another amazing guest today. We are joined today by Dr. Emily Gutierrez, who is a doctor of nursing practice and a pediatric nurse practitioner that specializes in integrative and functional medicine. She is board certified in functional medicine, pediatric mental health, and clinical nutrition, and is a fellow of the Medical Academy of Pediatric Special Needs, which is where I happen to meet her. Dr. Emily is also adjunct faculty at Johns Hopkins University, owns a busy private clinical practice in Austin, Texas, and is founder and co-owner of the supplement company Neuronutrients. And she managed with all of that stuff to make time to come and talk to us today. So we are very grateful for your willingness to come and share your expertise with our audience today, Dr. Gutierrez. So thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me. This is going to be fun.
I'm going to like spoil a little bit here, Jody. Hopefully this is okay. I know that Jody was very excited that you agreed to come and talk with us. I don't know if you remember, Jody saw you many years ago as a patient. And she said that one of her favorite things that she got, I'll just go ahead and Jody, you share your own story. I don't need to speak for you.
We were still a little somewhat new to it. And I had never really been in the functional medicine world. And you did genetic testing on my daughter when she was just at her worst. And we were trying to figure out all of the pieces. And to me, like the genetics piece of it, I'm an aspiring genetic nerd. It was just so fascinating to me. And I literally spent years like looking at like all the stuff you guys already know, like just trying to learn more and more about it. So this is I love this topic and just such a, as PANS moms, we talk about this a lot. So I'm excited to even learn more.
Awesome. Yes, you know, in the genetics, the companies that I use when I saw you guys to kind of like tried out a few different companies, and it's just we're all learning all the time. There's so much to learn and there's so much being researched and discovered, and there's a lot to know about genetics. But yeah. I find the same when you get the bug and you really start to understand that some genes really affect the way that you're functioning or your child is functioning. You just want to know more. How can you support it? What can you do? You know, so it can be really exciting and really impactful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, let's go ahead and dive in. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a doctor of nursing. So somebody said it was a doctorally prepared nurse practitioner. And I think that's a good way to say it too, but as nurses, we just like to keep adding letters behind our name, which is confusing. And really not even all the nurses know what all those letters mean. So I'm a lifelong learner. And my main goal in my patients is to improve their outcomes. And the most rewarding work is when you have a child that has a pretty significant disability or something going on with their health. And it just is transformative for them, and they get back on track, and it doesn't only help the child, it helps the entire family. And there's just very basic things that I've learned over my career that you can do. And then, you know, there's basic things that, you know, not a lot of people are aware of or doing. And then there's really nuanced and specialized things like genetics. So we opened Neuronutrition Associates about 11 years ago. Before that, I was in the emergency room for a little bit of time. I was in primary care, which I loved my primary care experience. I think that's so foundational for really being able to do this work is really understand primary care first. And then, you know, by accident almost, I opened this practice. After I got my doctorate at Hopkins, I really wanted to start focusing more on an integrative approach. And, you know, anybody that knows integrative medicine, you're eventually going to learn functional medicine. So it's just like this journey that takes you on a whole new definition of what your career is like. So I've been doing that. And then, you know, about 2 to 3 years ago, we started up Neuronutrients, just compounding supplements, really started with the pandemic. Remember when you couldn't find vitamin C anywhere? Yep. Yeah. We compounded our first immune support then. And it was like, okay, what are were the top most evidence-based things that actually work for a virus. And we put the combination together and it was so fruitful and so meaningful that I'm like, oh, you know, I can do this for children and the brain and just the brain in general. And that has been really a fruitful journey as well. It's exciting. It's fun. And, you know, it's another job that I like to take on. So I just personally, if you want to know anything personal about me, I'm in Austin, Texas. Our city motto is we keep it weird. And really what that means is people do challenge the allopathic paradigm here. They like something that's a little bit alternative. And that first went into practice when everybody was challenging me on like, do I need these antibiotics? Do I need this vaccine? Like, you know, do I need all these things? And can't you give me something different? And I really wanted to meet my patients where they were at and provide them health in my healthcare. And it just felt so much like sick care. So, yeah, in that, yeah. And then I have an almost adult child who's in Colorado, pre-med, and I have an almost adult teenager that has one more year of high school. So that's kind of where I'm at.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us.
What made you interested in working with this population?
Oh man. Well, one of my first jobs after the emergency room is I worked with special needs kids in a elementary school. And, you know, I was doing tubes and trachs and suctioning, and it was all we called them back then the severe and profound kids. And it's just the most meaningful work you can do. It really is. Like to love a child, to care for a child, and to care for the family. It just, my heart, my spark for special needs children really, really started then. So anybody that does pediatric functional medicine and chronic medical care, I mean, if you're not touching neurodevelopment and autism and neurodevelopmental delays, then I mean, there's a huge gap in your practice. So it's a natural fit. This type of medicine is a natural fit for chronic illness and disease. And I would say neurodevelopmental delay and autism is a chronic developmental condition. So it's a natural fit.
Well, let's just go ahead and dive into the meat of what we brought you in here to talk about, what I know people are dying to learn more about, which is genetics and genomics and how to figure out all the things that are going on with your body. So let's start with some basics for people who might be new to this. Can you tell us a bit about like genetics, genomics, and epigenetics and basic definitions for what those things are?
Yes, it can be a little confusing because some of those definitions are very similar. So genetics is the study of heredity and inherited characteristics, where genomics is the study of a person's genes. Epigenetics is behaviors and environments around genes that can affect the expression with how they're working. I always tell patients like, okay, you know, if you have the celiac disease genes, but you don't eat gluten, you're not going to get celiac disease. And that's one example of how we can change our environment around our genes to have the best expression of them or to avoid a disease expression. So most people know we have 23 sets of chromosomes because of 23andMe, which is really awesome. But within those chromosomes, you know, there's 23 sets with an X, you know, and then we have our sex chromosomes. 2X is a girl, XY is a boy. Those chromosomes are embedded with our genes, and it's estimated, I don't know, and maybe you guys can inform me the specific number of genes, because most people say it's between 20 and 25,000 genes. So that means that they also have 300 billion base pairs, and they're encoded in these nucleotides. So these letters, A, C's, T's, and G's that code for a gene. So when you're born, you get a code from mom, you get a code from dad. And when there's a variant in those genes, one of those codes can be missing. So, you know, what can happen is you can get a C instead of a G. So the risk allele. So just because, you know, when you have that, it's really known as a single nucleotide polymorphism. When you tell that to patients, like they start to gloss over, really. And Dr. Sharon Hausman-Cohen, who owns one of the genetic companies that I use, she caught me calling them mutations. And she said, Emily, you know, we should really call them variants, not mutations, because it doesn't sound as harsh. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that actually feels a lot better. Because honestly, we all have these variants. It's estimated that 1 out of 1,000 genes has a single nucleotide polymorphism. So with all those base pairs, that means that there are roughly 4 to 5 million SNPs in our body or variants. So when a gene is not, doesn't get that right code of life, then typically the enzyme function has some, it really has, it's not working as well. So there's some reduction in efficacy from it in some genes that we've studied, but we haven't studied all genes and we're still really new in the scientific field. So what I personally really love to look at when I'm looking at gene mutations are odds ratios for the genes. So odds ratios are there. It's a little nuanced to understand an odds ratio. So even providers are like, wait, let's go over what an odds ratio is again. But
yeah,
the greater the odds ratio of a gene having it, the greater that it's likely going to affect the person. So for example, if you have a gene that has a risk ratio, an odds ratio of 1, that's like the normal, that's an average ability for that gene to have the maladaptive expression. If it's 1.5, it's 1.5 times greater that the disease would be expressed. So you can see that like the higher the odds ratio, the greater the impact that that variant in the gene pathway might have on someone. Mm-hmm. I think that's important to look at because yeah. There's lots of genes that have variants in them.
Yeah. I love that you brought up the important topic. It was even brought up at a conference recently where a presenter was calling it a mutation. And they're not mutations, right? It's just a normal variant that's swapped out where instead of having like one of the base pairs is just swapped out for the opposite one for a different one. And so as you said, this is a normal thing that has occurred in nature. There's reasons for it, right? And the truth of the matter is there are some genes that we see, the SNPs is what was like short for the single nucleotide polymorphisms, for anybody who was like, what is she talking about SNPs? I'm so lost already because of all this like big science talk. The SNPs, so the single nucleotide polymorphisms, sometimes the ones that is most prevalent in the population is not the highest functioning. So it doesn't necessarily mean, and the variants can also lead to over-functioning or lower functioning. And that's especially for the variants that are related to like the excitatory neurotransmitters. Like sometimes you have a hard time clearing them. Sometimes you clear them too quickly. It's not that there's this is good and this is bad. It's how do we work with these things together? And that's really where the epigenetics comes in, right? It's like your genes are what you have. The single nucleotide polymorphisms are parts of those genes, like a little section of it. And then how you live is the epigenetics that impacts or influences how those genes are expressed.
100%. Beautifully put. Beautifully put.
So let's just make sure we're really, really clear about one really important difference for people. And that is the difference between a genetic disease and a single nucleotide polymorphism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. A genetic disease is something that the expression is known to have virulence or to, you know, if you have this genetic disease, you are going to have this disease. Mm-hmm. So there are inheritable patterns to those. It depends on exactly what genetic disease that you're looking at. And then we also have to put that into the context, if we even zoom out even further, of chromosomal disease, right? Yes. So in chromosomes, I like to explain the chromosomes like if you just picture a house and you think about, you know, the chromosomes are like the foundation of the house and the framing of the house. Like it really shows you what the house is going to look like. But our genes are embedded within those chromosomes. So like think about the genes as the, you know, what roof you chose, what window dressings you have. And like, you know, your door is where it is. You're not going to take the door off and put it upstairs to get into your front, you know, your living room, but you might paint your door and it might go from red to green. So you can change the expression of your genes, but, you know, unless you bulldoze your house and start over, the chromosomes are set. Mm-hmm. But there's variances within chromosomes too, right? Because you can have parts that are missing. You can have parts that are duplicated. But what's important to know is typically when it's chromosomal, there's phenotypic, you know, phenotypically, you can see something different on a child or an individual. So, you know, their house looks different. Maybe it looks like they have low set ears or a big tongue or a wide forehead. So sometimes those are picked up when infants are young, and sometimes they're missed until, you know, teenagers have really long legs and long arms and are super tall. And then they might be thinking about some genetic diseases that go along with that.
Yeah. I think when I've explained it, and tell me if you agree with this explanation, that a difference between like a genetic disease and a chromosomal disease, which I think is really good to tell that they are different, but I sort of lump them together in that the genetic diseases and chromosomal diseases are more guaranteed, depending again on like penetrance and if you've got, if it's, you know, penetrance and dominance and all of that. So some genetic diseases require multiple different genes. And if you have to have a certain threshold that you've met, that you'll have the expression of the disease versus a sub threshold, like you might not have the full expression or a lower expression. And that's where we come into the word phenotype that you use, which is fantastic. Not everybody knows what phenotype means. So genotype is what your genes are. Phenotype is what we look like because of our genes and like how the genes are expressed. Just so we're making sure we're meeting people all the way where they're at.
Yeah. That's wonderful.
So the genetic component. So like if your chromosomes are the number of chromosomes you have or the number of chromosomes you're going to have, the genes that you have are the genes that you're going to have. The single nucleotide polymorphisms, again, are not changeable. But that's where we see more that things are turned on or turned off. There's not like full penetrance. It's more about certain functions in the body, not this disease is associated with this gene. It's this particular part of this gene helps us, our body function in this way. Mm-hmm. And the functioning might be affected by this variant that we have that is normal and has had a reason that it's existed and persisted throughout time in you know, human history. So is that, would you agree with that? And Jody, are we both making sense as we're talking about this? Yeah. I know it's a whole lot.
No, you're making sense.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I love it that, you know, when I first started studying, you know, what are all these gene variants mean? You know, a lot of people were not accepting that any of them had any impact on our health or were relevant at all. You know, I think Amy Yasko was one of the first person that wrote some books about it. And then Dr. Ben Lynch had a bunch of things that came out on it. But the geneticist, if you were going to bring a Ben Lynch report to a geneticist, they would just, you know, they might even be cruel to you about it. Not all geneticists are that way, but they're definitely not focused on these common variants that we find. You know, the work that I do now, I do look at things that are less common and higher odds to mm-hmm. see if it's going to be more important for the person or the patient. And that's kind of how I put that into context. However, one of the most common variants that we learned about, MTHFR, it's in over half the population that somebody would have that variant. And it can absolutely increase your homocysteine. Mm-hmm. So homocysteine is a non-essential amino acid that basically is a sign to us that you're not recycling it through one of your biochemical pathways called the methionine cycle. So when that homocysteine builds up, it's really a toxicant for your blood vessels. And it shows us that you're not doing a good job at reducing your B vitamins, making your detox chemicals. And really all of that is very much needed to also have healthy neurotransmission. So it's common, but it sure is impactful. And you will see it if if you're 30 and never had your homocysteine checked and you don't take B vitamins, you know, you can be pretty shocked with how high it can be. I'm curious, what do you think of low homocysteine in kids?
What, you're curious what I think of?
Yes, I'm totally curious.
Well, you know, I'm not somebody who runs labs anymore. So once upon a time, I was a person that ran a whole bunch of labs. I super geeked out on all sorts of things with genetics and genomics. And I, to be perfectly honest, I felt like we know so little about it that, and especially with really complex kids, I honestly, maybe I'm just not very good at it. Maybe you're just a lot better at it than I am. I felt like I made kids worse more often than I made them better with using what I learned to manipulate and like maneuver through the genes, because mm-hmm. there's so many things. So like, I always describe like the genetics as like this big super highway, you know, and if you try to, if something is backed up on one super highway and you try to go over to another, so I live in San Diego. If like the five is backed up and I try to go over to the 15, then the 15 is also going to get backed up. And so if I try to do the surface streets, there's going to be implications there too. And so I felt like I was just backing stuff up everywhere when I was trying to overfeed something and then like underfeed something and trying to work around. And I was like, I'm just creating more chaos and I'm creating crashes when I don't need to create crashes. I speak in metaphors a lot. So, mm-hmm. and I happen to be quite good at homeopathy. And I found that fortunately, mm. like a really awesome thing is that homeopathy does help work on the epigenetic level. And we can like geek out on that in a little bit if you want to as well. Mm-hmm. So it helps to just normalize things, and it helps to like work, make it so that the functioning that you have can be optimized if you're not messing with things and putting stuff in there that causes blockages. So I just personally stopped messing with all of those things, and I stopped doing all the testing. I was like, you know what? The body is pretty wise. If I give it the right homeopathic remedy and just have them avoid the stuff that's just generally not good for us, mm-hmm. it makes my life easier. So
I think testing has gotten better. Mm-hmm. And I also think that just really more time and research has happened, and just really making sure that you can't address every single variant in your genome. I mean, that would be ridiculous. When I'm going through reports, I tell parents, I'm like, don't worry, I am not going to put you on a supplement for every SNP. That would be insane. Yes. You know, but let's see what's the rarest. Let's see what has the highest odds ratio. And let's put that into context with what is happening with your child.
Yeah.
And then through context clues and what we're already seeing, you know, we can make some changes. And over time, what I've seen is if I do a blood workup or other testing, it's matching the genes.
Yeah.
It's matching that. So yeah. But low homocysteine to me, because I definitely wasn't trying to give you a trick question. Everybody has a different assessment on what it is. I don't think that there's just don't think anybody has a real grounded effort in it. But I heard one of the, you know, functional docs talking recently about how low homocysteine just means that, you know, that detox pathway below it, the transsulfuration pathway, you're probably really need some cysteine, because you're not getting it through, because your homocysteine is being depleted so quickly. Yeah. So,
No, I just love to see, I am really good at something that makes it not as important for me to check those things. And we find that people who do still check them, that homeopathy tends to normalize it. So I'm just sort of like, let it go. And I don't worry about it too much.
That's awesome. And you will run circles around with me with homeopathy. I mean, I just know the tiniest amount.
Yeah.
What I do find to be helpful with running some of these common things like homocysteine is if you run it on a mainstream lab like Quest or CPL and it's red, it catches the attention of even the most allopathic provider.
Yeah.
So sometimes you have to do that. You have to use like a lab that they're familiar with for them to trust the results.
Yes.
Which is kind of crazy, but very, very true. So, you know, like when I have an irritable bowel kid that has blood and high inflammation in their bowel, before I send them to GI, I'll do mainstream labs and send those labs with them. Yeah. If I can't get them turned around, because they'll believe it. But if they go with another stool study from another company, they're going to be like, oh, we don't believe this.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what does MTHFR variant look like in a PANS kid?
Oh man, I think
like clinically.
Clinically.
Yeah.
So first of all, that methylation pathway has 11 genes that is really important. And while MTHFR is one of the last steps you get before methylated folate, other steps along the pathway are really important. So if you have a kid with MTHFR, you know, that homocysteine will rise most of the time. You're going to have more depression, mood stuff. You can have more cardiovascular inflammation with it. And, you know, if you're not methylating well, which basically means that it's like taking apart things in your body. So I, gosh, how can I describe this really simplistically? I think a methylation is a way to break things down in your body to get them to the most active metabolites that are needed to then go and build on other processes needed in the body. So we do that billions of times a second, and there's rate limiting factors with how well you're doing that based on your genes. So MTHFR helps you take a really synthetic form of folate, and then the plant folates, and then the folates above that, something called folinic acid, which is very, very important. You know, that has to be methylated into methylated folate, which then, you know, does a lot of things. It helps you detox. It helps you build neurotransmitters. It helps to recycle your methionine pathway. So it's really, it's important, and it's easy. It's easy to support the epigenetics of poor methylation. You give methylated B vitamins, and you can really help a child kind of get back on track with their methylation in particular.
Yeah. I would say it's also just a word of warning. It's also easy to overdo it for these kids, because one of the things that, I don't know if you've seen this, Dr. Gutierrez, and I'm totally throwing a curveball at you here, but yeah, one of the things that I've seen is that when I tried to do that, I would end up overproducing those excitatory neurotransmitters, like I was talking about before. And then depending on what their, like the COMT or the MAO genes were, they might've had a harder time, clearing it. And like, this is a particular one for me that I always think about, because I happen to have an MTHFR variant and variants in both of those genes. And so I have like, what's called the warrior genes, right? Where like I can, once I get things made, I can like get going really fast, but they stay around longer than is maybe helpful. And so I've seen it in myself. And when I'm doing well, and like on the other aspect of epigenetics, where I'm like, if I'm sleeping well, I'm eating a lot of whole foods that are not, not processed, but like, fortified, that's what I'm looking for, fortified with synthetic nutrients. And if I'm, you know, taking care of my stress and all those sorts of things, if I take a methylated B vitamin, I am like, I am anxious and I can't sleep and I'm on fire. So like, have you had that experience? Cause I've seen that with a handful, honestly, a quite large handful, like a giant handful of PANS kids, that they're doing well. And then they start taking a vitamin and they're like, they all hear about the MTHFR and the methylation and cycle and all that sort of thing. So they're looking for methyl Bs, and then they take a methylated B multivitamin, and then suddenly their kid is super anxious and can't sleep. Have you had that experience much? Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And here's my lean after doing this for a while is, you know, you're going to hear about people overmethylating, or people believe in that concept of overmethylation. And then you're going to hear people say that's absolutely impossible to do. Mm-hmm. It just depends on who you ask. Okay. My clinical experience in my lean is you have to address inflammation first. First and foremost, for a very significant amount of time, typically with kids that I see for PANS PANDAS that were just starting to work on them, or they've had a flare and they were, you know, when we first start working together, you know, I have a kiddo right now, like all we're doing for 4 weeks is high dose anti-inflammatories with Omeprim and omegas and plasmalogens. And we're going to really reduce the inflammation before I come and start to methylate and throw any of those Bs in the mix. Because if I throw too much too fast, it's like pouring gasoline on a fire. Mm-hmm. So if you know, some people, like, for example, I have a depressed teenager that failed every SSRI there was, and you might gasp when you hear this, but what brought him out of his depression was 25 milligrams twice daily of methylfolate.
Oh, wow.
And it was the most significant thing. It turned around his life. Like, he was on his way. Mm-hmm. So I've seen,
when you need it, you need it.
Man, I've seen really high doses work super well. And you know, with the whole folate and folinic acid, so that's the one step before the methylated folate, you know, the prescription is 25 milligrams twice daily of that to overcome cerebral folate deficiency. Mm-hmm. So let me back up a bit on folinic acid.
Okay.
So folinic acid is the step before methyl. And a lot of kids with neurodevelopmental things, PANS, PANDAS, schizophrenia, autoimmune inflammation. It's through Dr. Richard Fry's work that we're starting to elucidate and really understand that they can have antibodies that are preventing folate from getting into their brain. Mm-hmm. So you can see high folate in the blood, and those kids can be on methylated folate, but you have something called a reduced folate carrier that even if you have these antibodies blocking the way that methylated folate's getting to the brain, folinic acid will go through that reduced folate carrier. And I've asked Dr. Fry, you know, why 25 milligrams? Why are you stopping there? Because he'll stop seizures with doing this. He said, because what we've studied is more than 25 milligrams twice daily there isn't any added benefit. Mm-hmm. So I definitely have kids on PANS pandas with folate receptor antibodies on really high doses of folinic acid.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So aside from MTHFR, what SNPs do PANS and PANDAS families need to be the most aware of?
Well, there's a couple of them that I don't know if they need to be aware of them. I think it just is, it's interesting how it is helping us to kind of understand PANS PANDAS a little mm-hmm. bit better. So there is a gene called a mannose binding lectin 2 where basically, if you have a variant in this pathway, you might not be able to recognize that there's a foreign invader on the cellular surface. So typically our immune systems, when we see a foreign pathogen, will induce the lectin pathway, which then activates the complement system and will get going on eradicating an infection. I mean, I can't tell you how many times that I've had a new PANS PANDAS patient and parents are like, he hasn't been sick. We don't know. And they're positive for illnesses. They're positive for strep. They're positive for mycoplasma. I just had a CDC positive Lyme kid today. CDC positive, which is not like nuanced Lyme. So, and no known tick bite, no known illness, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I bet you anything there's one of these variants in one of these pathways. And it just makes me hypervigilant about, you know, looking for infection and clearing infection when it's appropriate. Especially just giving people the link that your immune system and infection really can it really be impactful on how your brain is functioning. Mm-hmm. And that amount of inflammation wreaks havoc in your neurotransmission. So another inflammatory cytokine, one of the other genes that can be important is your tumor necrosis factor alpha. So this is a gene. So this gene, if you have a gene variant in this, you're less likely to be able to control inflammation through this pathway. And unfortunately, this is one of the inflammatory genes, or not, excuse me, genes, but cytokines that easily crosses through the blood-brain barrier. This with interleukin-6 in particular. And when you have more inflammation cross into the brain, all kinds of things happen with glutamate dysregulation. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to go to, I mean, do you have any questions about that?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many, genes that could affect kids. I know that like histamine comes up a lot too. Do you have any, I know off the top of your head, do you have any like particular histamine things that people should be aware of, genes affecting or SNPs affecting histamine?
You know, well, when there is so much inflammation and you have problems controlling histamine and that mast cell activation. Certainly that's why, you know, some of the over the counter PANS flare cocktail, mm-hmm. have you seen what parents are giving?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. One of them's Benadryl, mm-hmm. right? So histamine is excitatory. Histamine is something that could be stimulating. Mm-hmm. That's why, you know, you take a Benadryl and for most people, unless you have that paradoxical reaction where you get hyper on antihistamine, which about 10% of the population does, it's going to make you sleepy because it's activating. So anything that's activating your nervous system, you know, causes more hyperexcitability in the brain. So, So inflammation is important. You can actually do a tumor necrosis factor alpha and interleukin 6 on blood work that your pediatrician would recognize. Mm-hmm. You know, pediatricians are not taught to do really any blood work unless someone's been sick for more than 7 days, or it's when they're 9 months or 4 years or 10. And that's when they're trained to do blood work.
Yeah.
as you know, in functional medicine, we're like, what's happening? Let's get some blood work. Let's try to figure this out. So inflammation is so important, because when you can downregulate the inflammation and you can stop that, you're going to stop all the upstream harm that it's causing from being so out of control. Mm-hmm. There was this great, maybe you can list it in the show notes, but it was published and I think it was in 2017, glutamate and glia, and just talking about in the immune system, talking about how just inflammation causes glutamatergic disruption in the brain. And I thought it was like one of my favorite articles ever written. So I'll send it to you. I reference it all the time with patients and pull up the charts.
Yeah, that would be great. We'll make sure we definitely get that in the show notes. I would love if you'd send it to us.
Yeah, it's really important. It's just like, guys, let's just take a step back. If you have a kid that all of a sudden has horrible OCD, separation anxiety, behavioral manifestations where they can't control their behaviors, and you're like, what happened to my kid? There was no trauma. What is going on? It's the answer today is put him on Prozac. Mm-hmm. And that is the only answer we typically have.
Yeah.
And it's really crazy making to me. And I'll prescribe Prozac. I'm not anti-medication, but I am anti trying to figure out what genes are being turned on. Mm-hmm. Where's the infection? Where's the inflammation? How can we control that first? So we don't just cover up, like give them more serotonin. Well, you know, for some people, more serotonin is too activating.
Yeah.
Did you, when you were doing genes, ever run pharmacogenomics?
Yes, I did that a lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
I found that so that's actually really, fantastic. Segue to asking you more about testing. So I think that we would like to know what the best way to get testing done is. And then you and I can like talk about the pharmacogenetics aspect too a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you want to test for MTHFR, most mainstream labs do it right now. Do you want me to say who I'm using testing wise?
Mm-hmm.
I just really have gotten really spoiled with Intellix DNA with, Sharon Houseman Cohen. Mm-hmm. I've used multiple genetics companies over the years, and Sharon's here in Austin, Texas, and she knew about my practice, and she tried to contact me for a year before I would have a meeting with her. And boy, when we met, she's like, Emily, just pull up. She just said this, and I don't want to say anything harmful about any other company ever. That's not my intent. But she asked me to pull up the references on a lab that I was using. And we went through how the references were not matching the genes. And ultimately, I'm a snob and I'm an academic snob. And it was like my heart sunk. Mm-hmm. You know, my heart sunk because I want to use a tool that's validated. I want to use what's been researched, with knowing the nuance that not everything that's going to help our children are researched. I mean, who's researched all the combinations of nutraceuticals or homeopathy? And, you know, there's so much art in this, but I want to be as scientific as I possibly can. So I was kind of hooked after that. And she's one of my really great friends now. So
that's a company that you trust for that.
100%. And you can go to their website and request. There's providers all over the US that use Intellix now. Their work really was with Del Bredesen in the neurodegenerative space at first, and they showed some efficacy using her tools for that. Mm-hmm. And one of the doctors, Dr. Heather Way in Australia, said, hey, you got to do this for autism. Mm-hmm. And started doing it for autism. And then she created the PANS Pandas panel. Mm-hmm. But it's also a tool that when there's new research, she's adding genes, she's adding research, like it's constantly being updated, and it's always the most current thing that you can find on the market. So
that's good to know that's one that you trust, but that's also one that's out of pocket for most people, right?
Oh yeah.
Are there any tests that you trust that maybe would be covered by insurance?
Yeah. You know, instead of having the genes. So MTHFR sometimes is covered under insurance. There's actually an ICD-10 code for it, so you can put it as a code to run it. Mm-hmm. You might want to call your insurance ahead of time and make sure that they're going to cover it. But that is a gene that a lot of insurances will do now. There is a company called Genomine that runs some pharmacodynamic genes too, and you can do that through insurance as well. And pharmacodynamic really means, you know, how our genes influence our epigenetics, right? Mm-hmm. Our gene expression. So, but otherwise, if you're worried about inflammation, it's not just a CRP and SED, right?
Yeah.
You can run an interleukin 6, you can run a tumor necrosis factor alpha. You can run those in blood and see them. Mm-hmm. So I think that can be very helpful, because then you need to know, you can track how aggressive your anti-inflammatory protocol needs to be.
Yeah.
And you can make sure that you've really addressed that before you're starting to add other things like methylation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you mentioned the pharmacogenetics, like that's one place where we really started to tiptoe into this. And for the longest time, I felt like that was the most useful, especially when I was seeing a lot of people who were on psychiatric medications or considering mm-hmm. psychiatric medications. And even to this day, that's one that I will still say, this would be worthwhile considering if you are considering taking a psychiatric medication. And so the pharmacogenetics means it's like the medication and gene interactions. And so what it's really trying to look at is, with your genetic variants that you have, is this particular medication more likely to be, it's not so much, will it help? It's looking at, will it harm? And so that's really vital, especially when you're dealing with super sensitive kids, like kids who have PANS and PANDAS, to know that you're going to not give them something that could potentially make them substantially worse because it's going to have a negative interaction with their genetic variants that they have.
Yes. And it's just so, I mean, I'm just aging myself probably, but you know, a decade ago when I first started using pharmacogenomics, you know, some of the psychiatrists here in town that are friends of mine, they're like, oh, Emily, that doesn't matter. No, we don't use that. We don't look at that. We know what to do. Don't worry about mm-hmm. it.
Yep.
And now those psychiatrists are ordering pharmacogenomics panels. I just did the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, that's put on, their CEU summit, and I did it. And, you know, they had a whole lecture on pharmacogenomics because you do know the gene pathways. So our most of our medications are metabolized through our liver. Mm-hmm. And so if you have a variant in a liver pathway, that means that you can either metabolize the drug really fast. Mm-hmm. So the standard dose doesn't touch you and it's not therapeutic. But if you metabolize it really slow, a standard dose can feel really toxic and you can have a lot of side effects. So now we can predict the dose better. Is this an appropriate medication for you? And if so, where do we start on the dosing? How low do we go? How slow do we go? So I clinically have found it to be pretty useful.
Yeah. No, I think that that's still definitely something that's useful. It's not as useful to take those and like turn it into, well, what do I need to do with my supplements and my diet and all of that? That's not
quite
useful for that. But it is useful for that level of decision-making. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So my last question for you then is what does, before we shift all to the like mom questions that Jody is just dying to ask, what do you really feel like the testing helps to inform? Because I don't know about you, but I've gotten very, very much like, well, if this testing isn't going to change something, and especially when so many tests are covered or not covered by insurance, they're out of pocket, and we're dealing with PANS and PANDAS, so many things are not covered by insurance, so that will hopefully change very soon, and hopefully someday this will be a very dated podcast, because insurance will be mandated to cover it in every state. I know in California there's something that's going to be heard. By the time this airs, it'll have already been heard. Hopefully we'll be moving through the legislature to mandate that. All that to say, I am not a fan personally of running a test that isn't going to dictate something that is going to change what I'm going to do one way or the other. So what mm-hmm. does the genetic testing really help inform for people if they're going to do it?
It helps me to inform my care for the child. So say we find a B6 gene that has a double copy variant in it, and the odds ratio is really high and it's a rare B6 variant. Instead of giving them, you know, 20 milligrams of pyridoxine hydrochloride, that's just B6, I might give them 100 milligrams of pyridoxine 5-phosphate. Mm-hmm. So And some of those genes around B6 are related to seizure disorders. It's the number one reason that someone could have a seizure. And we know in PANS, PANDAS, and autism, seizures are a big comorbidity that we see a lot of, whether it's because of poor methylation, poor folate absorption into the brain. It's multifactorial, but you know, that variant would be really important to know for that kid. You know, there's a Shank variant for autism. Shank means that you're not scaffolding the neurons. The connectivity is weak. So you would high dose zinc in that person, like give them a lot of zinc, way more than the upper tolerable limit that the government has set. So it does inform my care, and mm-hmm. it does give me clues where I wouldn't see them otherwise. Mm-hmm. And then selfishly as a provider, it backs me up, backs yeah. up my care. I had a friend recently that had their neurologist report the family for over-medicalizing their child. They reported him to CPS. Mm-hmm. And there's this beautiful, I mean, it's a beautiful family that is really just trying to help their kid not have, you know, tonic-clonic seizures that all the drugs aren't helping. And, you know, the neurologist reported them to CPS. And they had genetics on file. They had some hard data on file. And I think that that made the family feel like they had some backup for, yeah. you know, the treatment. So
yeah,
it helps with that too.
No, that's definitely, I mean, something I hadn't really considered when it comes to testing, that the aspect. I do know that like the testing can inform what you choose to give, and like for you, like which thing you're going to focus on mm-hmm. and how aggressive you're going to be. So with homeopathy, the main thing we need to do, we need to remove obstacles to healing and then stimulate the body to heal with the appropriate homeopathic remedy. And so to me, the genetic variants can help us identify some of the obstacles to healing. And so awesome. Some of the things that we need to avoid. So I'm looking at it from both sides, right? Like sometimes it's what do you need to take, but it just as much tells you what you need to avoid. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's a place that it can be informing us. And I say this just to speak to any of our listeners who are like, my kid won't take supplements. My kid won't do this. Like this is useless if I can't get my kid to take all of these things, or are feeling overwhelmed by like the, you know, your brain just going in a million places, like, you know, all the genetic pathways and all the biochemical pathways, that it can still be like, oh, I should not be giving my kid fortified food because it's got folic acid in it. And folic acid is going to block up my kid's methylation pathways because they've got this particular variant. So it can give you some information about that. It can help you understand the importance of things like, you know, meditation practices and things like that, that are going to be more helpful in regulating some of these genes on that epigenetic level, not so much about what you take, but what you maybe take away.
Yes. There's one gene on the Intellix. It's all around adrenaline too. And, you know, every parent that I've, maybe I shouldn't say every, but nearly all parents that I have reviewed the report around the adrenaline, they're like, you know, when I'm like, well, you know, does your kid rage? Do they get angry and seem to go to 10 really quick? Does it take them longer to recover? And then just being able to see that it's like, oh, it's like with the catecholamine O methyltransferase gene or the COMP gene, you know, you don't regulate your catecholamines as well. So you can just really feel that activation for so much longer. And when you come to that realization, like, oh, here, this is my biochemistry. This is what I've been blessed with. And this is what, you know, why box breathing can be really important for me. And yoga is a good form of exercise because I need to learn how to, you know, I need to learn how to manage my feelings in a different way. And it's helpful to know that here's the biological plausibility of it.
Yeah.
And all of our kids are born with all of their feelings. They're so good at feelings. They're really poor at managing them. They don't have the tools for them. And then once they really start to get it during childhood, they go into adolescence and then there's all these new feelings. So I'm just feeling like, you know, kids are, when there's more, when you can explain it more and it helps to take the blame off of you're a bad kid, you're a bad person, you just can't control yourself. It's just a relief in a way to see it. So I appreciate that about it.
Well, let's go ahead and shift gears to talk about what all the moms are wanting to know that. So Jody, let's do your magic and read the minds of the moms.
Yeah, no. And I feel like I can talk, and this actually is going to start with a question, because, you know, whenever I went through this with my daughter, it was a long time ago. And from what I understand, there's been some changes to the way that 23andMe works. And so I had one kiddo that I did testing with you, and one kiddo that I did just the 23andMe and got all the information. I have a very strong opinion on which one was good and which one wasn't, which one worked well and which one did not. But what do we do whenever we have all of this information and it's like, oh my gosh, like this is like rocket science to me. What do we do with that? How do we figure all of the things out?
Well, first of all, realize nobody has it all figured out, you know, and there's some genes that are likely going to make more of an impact, and you can't, I mean, I can't tell you how parents will just gloss over, and I know I've lost them, if we talk about too much all at once. So, you know, typically homozygous genes are a little bit more, like when you have a double copy variant, they're a little bit more impactful. But not always. It really depends on the gene. So if there's a gene that you're looking at, you can literally put the RS number and the gene in the browser, and then all the information will come up about what it studied. So you can read how that gene has been studied. You got to take it in bite sizes. You got to know there's a lot of heterogeneity or just differences in how people approach them, value them, use them. And honestly, at the end of the day, you know, do no harm, right? So if you found that, you know, your child has MTHFR and you want to methylate them or give them a methylated B, you just start really low and slow and make sure inflammation is in check before you do it. And, you know, you can always take it away if they're starting to get activated. So I will say that, you know, vitamins don't have an Advil effect typically. Like what we've talked about earlier with activation with Bs, you typically see that right away. But like with help with B vitamins, you need to give them for at least 6 weeks to really notice an effect. And really by 3 months, are you changing the physiology and changing the amount of homeostasis that you had prior to giving it? You know, homeopathy is quite different, right? You see something pretty quickly. Not with vitamin therapy as much. So long answer to your question is don't get overwhelmed. No, this isn't a perfect science. Take a few genes at a time and do no harm with what you decide to do with them.
I'm going to add work with a healthcare professional who understands this in a lot more detail, because you could end up even, you know, I'm a pretty smart cookie. Like I loved genetics in my undergrad. Like I geeked out on this stuff, and I still felt like I was, as I said before, jamming up the highways and jamming up the surface streets and all of the issues that came with it. And so it's really useful to work with somebody who does this all day, every day, and has expertise and understands PANS PANDAS because of just how sensitive these kiddos can be and how things can go haywire, that like so many things that should work, quote unquote, should work. Mm-hmm. End up having like different responses for the kids with PANS and PANDAS. So working with somebody would be my first and foremost thing that I would say, and then tell them to go low and slow, a few at a time, and do no harm.
Yeah, I love that. I hear, here. I totally support that as well.
And that's what the didn't work side of it was for me, when, you know, going at doing genetic testing with you and you coming with this lovely spreadsheet and okay, here's what we do. Here's the first little chunk. And then the other kiddo that I was like, oh, like I understand this. I can do this. Like, and doing it myself and this whole like report. And I'm like, I have no idea what's going on. So I definitely agree with doing it with somebody that knows what they're doing. To help you even understand what you have in your hands afterwards is a really important thing. Mm-hmm. So I have seen this with my own daughter, so I understand it. But one of the things I did not understand in the beginning, I would hear moms talk about genes being able to be switched on and switched off. Can you explain a little bit about that to us?
Yeah, I think it goes back to that epigenetic modulation, meaning that, you know, your expression of a gene has a lot to do with the environment around the gene. So, for example, if I have depression genes that run in my family and I refuse to get psychotherapy after a lot of trauma, I'm more likely to be depressed. And, you know, another example is if I pick up a cigarette and start smoking, I'm more likely to become addicted to nicotine because I have those genes in my genome that says, hey, Emily, you have this. If you start smoking, you're going to like it and you're not going to want to stop. So it's about choosing not to smoke. It's about, you know, choosing to take care of yourself in a different way so you don't turn on those pathways that really can lead to chronic disease.
Yeah. Yep. That's why the epigenetics matter as much or more than what the SNPs are, because, you know, that's one of the reasons that we have persisted and survived. Like people, that's just going back to the beginning when we talked about it's not a mutation, it's a normal variant that is just different. It has different penetrance in the human population. And so it is a normal variant of a perfectly, like a way a gene is supposed to be. It's not a mutation. And it's only affecting us more recently because of some of the things that we're doing. So I'm always like, well, you know, the genetic variants weren't a problem until we started, you know, eating food made from factories and putting chemicals everywhere in our house. And so that's what we're talking about with epigenetics is that the genes become a problem when we do things in our life that switch it on or turn, you know, like, you know, methylation is part of whether something is turned on or turned off as well. And so they all feed each other too. So not just because you have a gene doesn't mean it is always turned on. You know, there's plenty of people who get, you know, breast cancer, you know, that have, it's a really commonly known gene, right? BRCA gene. There's plenty of people who get breast cancer who don't have BRCA, and there are people who have BRCA who don't get breast cancer. And the difference in those things is the epigenetics that leads to the formation or non-formation of this rapidly producing out of control reproduction of cells that happens on the genetic level too. So
that's right.
Okay. Jody, did you have anything else? Any other burning mom questions?
No, I think that's it.
Okay. I think everybody's brain is spinning after an hour of this level of geekiness. So we're going to go ahead and wrap for today. Emily, thank you so much for joining us. We're so grateful for the time that you've offered to us. How can people find you or get in touch if they want to learn more?
So on our website, Neuronutrients, I have some podcasts. I'll end up listing this one under podcasts. I think the tab is resources. So there's things under there. Also, you know, I've written a book on kids with autism. It's been about 5 years now. It's called The Functional Medicine Approach to Autism. Neuronutrition Associates is my practice. Mm-hmm. There's some information there. So, and then we have, of course, Instagram, Neuronutrition Associates. So you can find me there as well. I like to post meaningful, relevant things on there. Even if it is, wow, I found the best chicken nuggets that are gluten-free and have good ingredients. So you can find me there.
That is super useful. That's super relevant. Well, we'll make sure we put links to all of those things in the show notes. Once again, thank you for your time. And it was really great to get an opportunity to talk to you about genes and genetics and genomics and all of these fun things. So thanks for geeking out with us.
All right. Thanks for having me. Everyone take care.
Take care, everybody. Bye.
We hope you found this episode helpful, hopeful, and inspiring. We try to get a new episode out every week. You can make sure you don't miss any by following us on Spotify or subscribing to our channel on YouTube. If you want to connect with us more, join our Facebook group, Homeopathy for Pans and Pandas, where we have exclusive weekly videos and answer your questions about, you guessed it, homeopathy for pans and pandas throughout the week. If you are already a member, give us a shout out and let us know what you thought about this episode. If you aren't on Facebook and would like to reach us, you can email us at podcast@resiliencenaturopathic.com. Until next time, take care and remember, this won't be forever.